This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring and where we talk about writing and life. I am your host, Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
When I was in high school, the classes I loved most were English and music. I grew up in a small central Massachusetts town. My high school was not all that good, honestly. In many of our English and lit classes, the teacher would show us the movie of a book instead of making us read the book. I recall a movie of A Tale of Two Cities and of The Scarlet Letter. I also remember actually having to read Tess of the D'Urbervilles and not really being able to even make it that far into the book, then also being shown the movie and still kind of zoning out through it. To this day, I have no desire to go revisit Thomas Hardy, but maybe that'll change at some point. What I do remember, though, was loving Greek mythology. I loved learning all about the gods on Mount Olympus, who they were, what they reigned over, who they married and who their children were, and then all the interminglings of some half-god, half-humans. Honestly, I didn't really like when they started watering down a bit. That was less interesting to me. I most recall the story of Hades and the three-headed dog Cerberus and Persephone going down for half the year and her return being the sign of spring. I loved all those long, complicated, to my ear, names, Agamemnon and Polyphemus. And when we were assigned to read the Odyssey, I started catching on that our teacher, Mr. Iacovacci, especially liked paying attention to all the characters that got introduced. So in one particular segment, I underlined and then recopied all the new people who had come into the story in just one section we were assigned to read. Well, the next day we had a pop quiz for which we got bonus points for naming every new character. I think I was doing really poorly on the other parts of the quiz, but I made up for it by naming all the new characters that had been introduced. I was very pleased with myself. I felt an enthusiasm for these stories when I would be sitting down with my parents in the kitchen, dreaming and imagining what I might want to do when I grew up. I would muse to them, maybe I could tell people stories for my job. I think they were amused by me. I imagine them giving each other a silly little grin, very curious to hear what I would come up with next. How would that work? They wanted to know. And I had a whole vision for it. Well, I could set up a little window like Lucy in the Peanuts and charge people a buck to tell them different myths. So today, when I think back to that enthusiastic, naive teenager I was, I imagine what she might have thought if I had been able to whisper in her ear, you know what you're going to eventually be able to do? You won't even have to tell stories for a job. You will eventually get paid to listen. What? That's right. Paid to listen to stories. I do this by producing audiobooks, which brings me to today's episode for you. I want to share with you the stories that I have had the great honor and privilege of producing into audiobooks this year. I still pinch myself when I think of how I have found my way to this work. If you've listened to even one episode of this podcast, you know I am most passionate about hearing writers read the story of their own lived experiences out loud. I can't stop musing about why this is unique and special, but for now, let's just accept that it is. But listening to audiobook after audiobook, where the writer was the narrator, was my inspiration for starting this very podcast. Then it was thanks to memoirist Charlotte Maya and her book, Sushi Tuesdays, that I broke into the business of being an audiobook producer. It was one little inquiry once the mics were turned off. I noticed you don't have an audiobook of your story. Will you have one? She didn't, and she was actively in pursuit of doing so. Long story short, though I had never produced anything as massive as a full-length book, I knew it was something I could do. Absolutely. I even surprised myself with my own assuredness. And I knew she could do it too. Et voila. We became what I call audio partners. She read, I hit record and listened, carefully. Then edited. We fixed all the flaws, and Sushi Tuesdays became my debut audiobook production, which I am so proud of. Because it was the project that led me to feel that I was born to do this, work with an author to record their words about their lived experience. It's one thing to be a narrator. That is something that takes a huge amount of practice and skill. But what every memoirist has is the practice and skill of living that experience. So the feeling of the story is already in their bones. And on top of that, they've also been through the hard work of writing and crafting it into a comprehensive story that's then been vetted and edited into something worthy of publication. The icing on the cake, if you ask me, is then reading it out loud. Another even deeper layer of expression, an embodiment of their words with their own unique voice. Back to another earlier incarnation of me. When I went to college, I became an English major because I loved stories and writing, and I wasn't really sure what I would do with it, but I was just going by feel of what I liked. Another carryover for me from high school was singing in the chorus, which I also feel like was and is my baseline, my foundation, music. So my freshman year, I set out to find the Northeastern Choral Society. I found out that they performed classical music. Our high school sang Barry Manilow and a lot of other pop hits. I really had no association with classical music other than every now and then pausing at a clean, clear signal of the classical radio station that was then at 102.5. Maybe I should listen to this, ha ha ha, I said to myself as a joke. But I think there was, again, another part of myself coming through in that brief moment. Anyways, back to the fall quarter of my freshman year, the chorus was singing Vivaldi's Gloria. I had no clue about Vivaldi. I almost walked out. But a friend from my dorm who was also joining the chorus seemed to be okay with it, so I thought, oh, I guess I'll give it a go. It was hard, and it was really fun. And the next quarter, we sang Mozart's Requiem, and I was hooked. I changed my major to music and never looked back. I'm telling you all of this because it is with that background about me that I have the first sample I want to share with you today from this year's productions from Flying Pig Audio, which is what I call my little independent audiobook operation. The music I have scored on these selections today are purely for your listening pleasure here. The audiobooks do not contain any kind of musical accompaniment, but I just have so much fun adding music to the words of these accomplished authors. I needed to just share it somewhere. So first up, what I will play for you today is a section from Nina B. Lichtenstein's debut memoir and essays called Body, My Life in Parts. You might have heard her talk about that earlier this year on the podcast. Each chapter is named after a body part and was written as she meditated on the stories that lived within her various body parts. It is quite inventive and a very creative way to unlock the stories that live inside of us. This one is a brand new one I have not played or she has not read before on the podcast. A small section from her chapter. It is called Ears.
I love to play loud music. Some of my happiest hearing memories are from when my kids were young and I would put on a CD or an LP, crank up the volume, and the boys and I would dance and twirl and run, exhilarated, throughout the house. Our favorite was an LP in my record stash from Norway, Edvard Grieg's Peer Gynt Suites, number 1, Opus 46, In the Hall of the Mountain King. The piece starts in a slow and rhythmic thumping beat, with just a few string and horn instruments playing in an explorative staccato. Bum, 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 bum. The boys and I become the trolls that inhabit Norwegian forests and mountains and move in slow motion, our arms wide and our steps big and heavy, faces stern and twisted on our tilted bobbing heads. As the measures pass, a few more strings join in, picking, and more wind instruments like flutes and clarinets and oboes enter, and we escalate our pace too, exploring the corners of the living room, around the couch, and in front of the fireplace. Our two Lasso Apsos follow us. Wanting in on the action, they sense the rising excitement and nip at our moving feet. The pace increases until more and more of the orchestra, all the strings, all the winds, the cymbals, and the drums join, and we move faster, the dogs underfoot, and circle the dining room table and run through the kitchen and back out to the living room where the tall floor speakers stream out the glorious music. The volume and the pace increase again when the strings become more assertive, as do the wind instruments, the clarinets, and the trombones, and the thumping rhythm quickens, and the sound gets deeper and more dramatic. At about 2 minutes in, with only 40 seconds to go, the entire Philharmonic Orchestra is playing every single instrument, and the tempo and intensity reach a crescendo in a frantic mass of loud, explosive, symphonic uproar that makes us run and twirl faster and faster and faster, until in synchrony with the last grand bangs of the bass drums and the final loud gong, we collapse together on the floor in a heap of exhausted troll bliss.
Oh my God, is that not the best thing ever? I just love it so much. Her reading about that turned out to be almost exactly the length of the piece by Grieg. So I was like, oh my God, I have to do this. It was so much fun to put it together. And funnily, that comes together in an interesting way because at one point, my chorus actually sang that piece with the New England Conservatory Orchestra in some performance. I don't remember what it was, but there are lyrics to that. There's like a choral part. Kill him, the Christian dog has bewitched the fairest daughter of our troll king. Kill him. It's that's how it goes. Oh gosh, I can't believe I sang. It's really bad. Anyways, I loved it. Nina, it was a huge delight to just stick that little piece of music with your piece. The next piece from Nina's book, Body, My Life in Parts, will actually make a little sense contextually as well, given the premise of her running around with her kids and doing all that playing when they were little. The next section I'm going to play for you, not scored, but from her audiobook, is the opening of her chapter entitled
Back. I got my own back. Maya Angelou. It happened in the bathroom as I turned to reach for the toilet paper. I felt something snap and knew immediately that I'd thrown out my back. The accident left me useless and helpless, but wasn't as much an accident as an unavoidable malfunction of my 36-year-old body that had carried 3 full-term pregnancies in little over 4 years. For a few days before, I had noticed something was not right, and I moved with a cautionary edge that made me wary of lifting and bending. I was hyper-attuned to any small twitch or change. This was, after all, a body part that had become particularly vulnerable after carrying huge babies, first in my womb, then in my arms and on my hip, often all three places simultaneously. Our way above average babies, read off the chart in height and weight, inherited a combination of my own Norwegian Viking genes and those of my 6'4" tall Jewish husband and his Russian ancestors, the mythical Kurganskis, or the Kurgans of the Russian steppe, known for its giants, really. The abdominal abuse of multiple pregnancies, weight gain, and subsequent lack of exercise had finally caught up with me. For as long as I can recall, I've always been the one to give others a ride on my back. When we played house or farm during recess in school, I was never the mom or the dad. Never, of course, was I one of the kids. I was too tall, so by default, I was the workhorse. A head taller and much stronger than all the other classmates, boys included, my career as a service mammal began early. As a teenager, I carried girlfriends on my back for fun, their long legs dangling heavy to my sides, and while babysitting, I gave countless children a rest during hikes. Little, clambering human monkeys enjoyed free rides up the stairs to coax them into their bedtime routines. Throughout my young adult life, I was always able and willing to do hard physical work, especially if it meant assisting others or earning some spending money. Need help moving furniture? Call Nina. Have some garden bins that should be hauled? Nina to the rescue. Stones? Firewood? Crates full of stuff? I've got it. No, let me. As a wife, it was I who schlepped our three massive trash cans up our long winding driveway to the curb every Tuesday night. And as the ultimate Jewish housewife or balabusta, elbow deep in preparations for Passover, I dragged the huge plastic crates filled with kosher for Passover china, pots, pans, glasses, and silverware up the basement stairs, pregnancy be damned. When I had my own three kids, it wasn't just their dad who was big and strong and physical. Boisterous romps and wrestling matches were plentiful with both mama and papa. It was all fun and games until the day my back went out, the kind of breakdown that made an invalid of this usually invincible woman and mother of three energetic boys under the age of 6. Injured, I could do little else with the kids except kiss them and remind them to be careful when they crawled into my bed to be close to me. Don't jump! No roughhousing! Be gentle with Mama! No more giving them baths, frolicking on the floor, or lifting them for those yummy belly-to-belly hugs. Even helping them dress was too difficult, as was wiping their tushies or cooking their meals. Our Norwegian au pair, Caroline, had just arrived from Norway the week before my collapse, and although it was a rough initiation for her, like jumping into icy water without any preparation, she didn't just float, she swam heroically, carrying our three little big cubs on her back as if they were her own. That day, on the toilet, it was what should have been a small, inconsequential rotation that caused the lumbar disc to slip and put the debilitating pressure on nerves so significant that, trying to stand up, I collapsed to the floor with a loud cry. Dan, who had not yet left for work, came running in from the kitchen. Unable to get up by myself, he lifted me from the floor and carried me up the stairs to our bed while I screamed like a hog going to slaughter. I had no potent painkillers on hand, only Tylenol and Advil, neither of which touched the pain, so I writhed in it until a friend who is an ER doc was able to come to the rescue. Commuting between hospital jobs in the US and Israel, Dr. Mark used to stay on our third floor when he worked his 10-day shifts in the States. Thankfully, he was local and able to come to the rescue an hour or so later. "Tell him I need something strong to kill this fucking pain," I moaned as Dan was on the phone with him explaining what had happened. Ask him to come as soon as he can. I'm dying here. In the relatively brief waiting period before he arrived, time was as if sadistically suspended, leaving me in some evil version of purgatorial torture. When Mark finally walked through our bedroom door, his appearance was the arrival of the Messiah, the promise of redemption incarnate. Known as a doctor with superior bedside manners, he looked into my eyes with empathic concern. He listened intently and agreed that I needed something stronger to help with the pain. I swallowed the pills he gave me, closed my eyes, and prayed they would work fast. I will never forget the relief as the meds began to work some 20 minutes after I inhaled them. That warm, numbing, and floaty sensation that I first noticed as tiny, giddy bubbles making their way through each limb toward my core as if they were alive and rushing to a party, gathering a gentle intensity as the minutes passed, until finally all the agony in my lower back evaporated. Or was it I who evaporated? Until I didn't really care about anything except the blessed absence of pain. Enveloped in this artificial bliss, resting on a cloud of mercy, my body and mind levitated far away from any possible calamity, every square inch of me sinking heavy and limp into the mattress. This salvation was what my body quickly learned to crave. My early redemptive meetings with the now infamous prescription pills hydrocodone, also known as Hydros, Lorries, Watsons, 357s, Percocet, also known as Perks, and OxyContin, also known as Kickers, Blues, Hillbilly Heroin, meant to be for temporary use until I healed, turned out to be the beginning of my brush with opioid addiction.
Whoa. And that's just the beginning of that story. Each chapter she has is a body part. This one is back, but each body part is broken up into distinct stories. This one back is actually sequential and contiguous and contains its own narrative arc, but not all chapters are the same. And that's one of the very fun things about this book, is it's sort of nonlinear and interesting because of how she goes into each one of her body parts. Anyways, for someone who might be trying to write memoir and is interested in this approach, she also has prompts in the back of the book that go into a process for doing this yourself if you are so inclined. So that book, Body, My Life in Parts by Nina Lichtenstein, is just out this month on audiobook. I am so, so excited. And in fact, if you happen to be in or near Brunswick, Maine on December 10th, Nina and I and her husband, Tony Perry, or Theodore A. Perry, as he is referred to on his books, will be doing a talk and playing more clips from both of their audiobooks, which I produced this year. Stay with us because I will be playing some clips from State of Maine, State of Mind coming up, as well as Memes Crepes, which are the two books written by Theodore A. Perry, a.k.a. Tony Baloney Perry. That might be something you are interested in attending. But before we get to Tony Perry, I have the next book that I worked on this past year with a writer who I have become friends with and have been watching for a very long time. I say watching as she has worked on this book. Her memoir is called The Mother of All Decisions. Her name is Betsy Armstrong. Perhaps you've caught another episode that I had with her as she was working on this book. It came out this past year in both book and audiobook form. I usually like to pick something that's kind of a fun teaser for you, and we will do that. But just to set it up for you, I think it would make the most sense to play the opening of Betsy Armstrong's book, The Mother of All Decisions, a memoir of mother loss, legacy, and adopting kids in midlife.
Part 1. Chapter 1. The subject is children. Subject line. Adopt a couple of kids? This was the only part of the email I changed, hoping to be a tad provocative, before I forwarded the information about adoption to my husband, Doug. It was a challenge to him, a gauntlet on the topic of family. Did we want one that included more than the two of us? I wasn't sure either, but I was tired of talking about children in fits and starts, of moving forward, then backtracking, of conversations that circled into nothingness, and mostly of how we avoided a firm conclusion, never deciding on the same idea at the same time. I could not believe I was doing this, prying the lid off of the Pandora's box labeled family that existed in my mind and spilling the contents into an email to Doug. I was about to be 47 years old, and Doug was 49. How would he answer? He might ignore me, which, with the hundreds of daily emails he received at work, was a possibility, or pretend he hadn't received it if he wanted to avoid the subject. If he gave a flat-out no, would I feel bereft? Or, if he agreed, would I freak out? Would an affirmative response be enough to satisfy my demons and let me hope? That I was even playing this game was my friend Debbie's fault. 4 years earlier, she and her husband Jacob had embarked on an unusual path. Jacob was divorced with a teenage son from a prior marriage. Debbie was pushing 50 with only passing mentions of maternal desire, so I'd never had an inkling that they wanted kids. They did. So much so that they had opted for a situation scary to all but the bravest of prospective parents. Older kids, plural, from far, far away. They had adopted two sisters, 9 and 11, from Russia. Debbie had been smart about it, though. Having heard the horror stories about uncontrollable kids with emotional problems and tempers, she had uncovered a way to minimize every mind-boggling risk associated with this sort of thing. They had met the girls here in the United States, brought them from Russia, and let them live in their house before being certain about adopting them. On the surface, it sounded horrifying, an audition with very high stakes. I'd never heard of such a thing and thought it seemed unethical and potentially damaging to everyone, especially a child who got rejected. What if it didn't work? The thing was, it had for them, and they claimed it did for most, whatever that meant. Although this wasn't a common practice in the adoption world, groups of older orphans traveled to America and stayed with families who decided to move forward with them. Jacob and Debbie now had two healthy, happy Russian-American daughters. Ever since Debbie had brought her girls home 3 years earlier, she had made it her mission to find parents for the friends they had left behind at the orphanage. Debbie had aimed her considerable charm and desire to do good at me, along with several others. Some of them had followed her lead and added at least one adopted child to their family. I admired the generosity of spirit these people displayed in welcoming the kids into their hearts and homes, but admiration alone wasn't enough for me to act. I could never adopt for some gold medal of selflessness. I wasn't that good of a person, honestly. So, while I was uneasy, I was also intrigued by the idea of older children I could get to know, a ready-made family if siblings were chosen. No diapers or terrible twos. I was curious. But only a very small, teeny tiny bit. At least that was what I told myself.
That's the opening, and it is quite a story that Betsy winds us through with this book. She has a lot of different facets, which we've talked about on a couple of the prior episodes. You can go check out if you are curious. But running is also another part of her story. And so this next clip I'm going to play is when she is working with an organization called Girls on the Run that works with girls to help them move for healthy activity and self-development. The next clip I'm going to play for you is also scored with some music that does not appear on the audiobook itself, but I did, again, just for the fun of it and for your listening pleasure here. So here we are with a later section in the book by Betsy Armstrong, The Mother of All Decisions.
As part of this job, I went to a meeting at the national office. On this morning, the founder had gathered us together to contemplate the question, what's next? Every meeting always opened with a visualization, and this was no different. Think back to where you were 10 years ago. I thought, I was just 31 years old, still reeling a year after Dad had joined Mom in the afterlife. Think about who you were then. Idealistic, alone. The exercise continued. Let's shift our minds from the past and the present. Project yourself 10 years into the future. What do you see? I did the addition and thought, 51. And then my mind became white fuzz and a gauze curtain dropped over the place where the future should have been. Breathe, I told myself. Concentrate. I couldn't. Try counting up year by year. See if you can sneak up on your future self. 41. Now. I love my life. I love Doug. This job is perfect for me. 42. Next year. Hopefully, I'll have completed the ultramarathon I'm signed up for and be in the best shape of my life. 43. It will be 2007 and 20 years since Mom died. A lump began forming in my throat. 44. 20 years since I did my first marathon in her honor. 45. Whoa, I'll be 45. Is it crazy that children never appear in my life? Maybe. Probably. I just don't see Doug and I with a kid. I wonder if I'll be lonely. 46. I'll be as old as Mom was when she died. What if I only have 5 years to live? The lump returned. The tears reappeared. I attempted to flash forward 10 years to when I'd be 51, but nothing was there. I couldn't see it. I felt the beginnings of a sob working its way up. I was going to cry. No, don't, I told myself. 51. Nothing. My eyes flew open, assaulted by the glare of sunlight reflecting on the conference room table. I blinked. Plop, plop. Two tears fell on the smooth surface. The sun shone on them, turning them into crystal prisms. I couldn't see it. My future stops at 46. There is no 51. What hadn't been obvious suddenly crystallized for me. I think I'm going to die when I'm 46, just like my mom.
Now available, The Mother of All Decisions, a memoir of mother loss, legacy, and adopting kids in midlife by Betsy Armstrong. Available wherever you get your audiobooks. And produced by Flying Pig Audio. Oh yes, that's me, tacked on at the end there. I forgot when I made this little promo for her that I had put that at the end. Well, now I don't have to tell you. I already told you. Oh, this is such a good book. I am so, again, all of... I just am so happy that I get to do this work with these writers. Both of them, aren't they just so wonderful? You can really hear them telling their story. That's what I love to do. All right, let's continue on because the last set of clips I have for you is a little bit different and sort of bookends the whole year for me. Nina's husband, Tony Perry, is a very accomplished author who has written much philosophy, language. I'm going to just read to you from the back of his book. He holds a BA summa cum laude from Bowdoin, an MA in French, and a PhD in romance studies, both from Yale University. He has published 13 books on literature and philosophy, and he loves collecting yarns for his own ongoing Perry Home Companion. Most recently, he has written a couple books that are about Maine and about his childhood. While these are not memoirs per se, they are definitely informed by his life. These are two absolute confections that I had the best time working on with Tony. The first one I'm going to play for you is a book that came out at the beginning of this year entitled Mémé's Famous Crêpes or Les Crêpes Célèbres de Mémé. That's my French. They are bilingual and it is a kid's book. It's illustrated. It looks like a children's book, but there's a lot more in it than just for the kids. If you decide to pick it up, you'll see what I mean. But I will play for you first a little selection of both the English and the French of Mémé's Famous Crêpe. And we did a very fun little sound that I recorded in my husband Phil's studio even to signify the page turns. Anyone who had a film strip back in the day had to flip the film strip as we went along. It's kind of like that. So little sounder for page turns. And here we are with Mémé's Famous Crêpes.
Let's start the story where they all should start, in Grandma Mémé's kitchen. The action starts at about 6:30 a.m. in the chicken coop, where I have been dispatched to gather up enough fresh eggs for breakfast. My younger sister, Andrea, who sleeps until at least 8 a.m., ain't all that much help. Nor is my brother, Stevie, who isn't even born yet. Today's a special occasion. One of the grand boys, Noah, and his sweetheart bride are coming over for some crepe, just like Mémé used to make 'em. My job, other than getting the eggs, is to come up with the exact recipe. And here it is, in 10 easy steps. Commençons l'histoire en entrant dans ma maison dans le Maine, là où tous les récits devraient commencer. Dans la cuisine de ma mémère, le branle-bas débute vers 6h30 dans le poulailler, où l'on m'envoie pour amasser assez d'œufs frais pour le petit déjeuner. Ma jeune sœur Andrea dort comme d'habitude jusqu'à 8h du matin. Elle n'est pas d'une grande aide. Et mon petit frère Stevie non plus, car il n'est pas encore venu au monde. Aujourd'hui, c'est une occasion spéciale. L'un des petits garçons, Noah, et son épouse adorée viennent manger des crêpes à la façon de mes mères. Mon travail, à part aller chercher les œufs, consiste à trouver la recette exacte. Et la voici, 10 étapes faciles.
Isn't that wonderful? I love the French. I can barely follow along. I really don't know French all that well. But that was just a little bit from the opening of Mémé's Famous Crêpe. And then moving on to a couple of selections from the final book that is also just out that Tony recorded with me this summer. This book is another little, just a little treasure. It is called State of Maine, State of Mind. And anyone who knows my passion for living in this wonderful, wonderful place, the state of Maine, you know, it speaks to the hearts of those of us who live here and love this place, even those of us from away, as we are known, those of us coming from places besides Maine. State of Maine, State of Mind came out in 2019, so it's not all that old, really. But I'm going to play for you two selections. One, the opening, so you get a sense of what the book is. And then it's a series of little stories as told by the character Huck Colby, who is the narrator for the book. So here we are. State of Maine, State of Mind, Upcountry Humor and Stories by Theodore A. Perry.
Preface. This book attempts to document and share with the outside world an unpretentious and wise way of life just north of the New Hampshire border in perennial upcountry called Maine. It aims to recover local stories and discussions popular in towns like North Harmony many summers and winters ago and still vigorous right down to the present day. The main question, of course, is why anyone would want to live in Maine in the first place. If you were born up here, then you already know. And if you weren't, it seems that lots of you folks from away might be wondering, why not? For you see, the jump from geography to real-life questions is just up the road, evoking laughter and deeper thoughts as well. This collection of local anecdotes offers some humorous samples, and especially their underlying Maine wisdom perspectives. The hero of many of these stories, Huck Colby, was a true representative of upcountry humor and local homespun sagacity, or whatever you want to call it. Have a good laugh, and perhaps learn to think a bit more deeply while you're at it. And if you're at all serious about simplifying your life, then burn your credit cards, save your cash, and buy a one-way ticket.
That is the preface. And now for one of the stories from Huck Colby.
Redoing the Kitchen. When Beatrice Latilip had her kitchen redone, Huck's wife Esther got the idea she wanted hers redone too. Huck said he'd look into it. Every morning after breakfast, Huck would pour himself an extra cup of coffee and just sit there staring the kitchen up and down. Then he would get up and walk around it in all directions. Then he would sit down again, deep in thought. This went on for quite some time. Then one day, Huck announced his new plan for the kitchen. As my old man used to say, it's fine just the way it is. From that day on, the family just seemed to enjoy the old kitchen even more than before. Whenever the matter came up with one of the kids or younger relatives, Huck liked to point out the following. You can get the new stuff any time you want, but the old stuff? He would clinch his argument with a question. When is the last time you were comfy in a rocking chair? Nobody seemed to understand what Huck meant by that, except the old folks, and they didn't need to be told.
Oh my God, that story is so good. I cannot tell you how much I love that story. It works for me on so many levels. And Tony, unlike I think every other author I've worked with, and this is no slight to them at all, Tony was a real consummate performer. He has been a cantor in his synagogue. He was a singer. He is much more of a performer, and it became really clear as he was telling his stories. This is really a storytelling book, and his mastery over his instrument is just unparalleled. It's really good. It's really good. And it's so beautiful, and it's so fun, and it's so much about Maine. I love it. Love it. So, Tony, thank you so much. I loved working on this with you. And State of Maine, State of Mind is also just now available. I really, really, really urge you to go get this book because it is a little gem. All right. Those are the books I worked on this year. I love doing this. I love doing this so much. And so I am very excited about a couple potential projects coming up for me in the new year. I am putting in the show notes links for all of these books if you are interested in purchasing the audiobooks, but mostly I really wanted to just share them with you. So the people I always thank at the end of my episode include, this time, Nina Lichtenstein, Betsy Armstrong, Tony Perry, and my husband, Phil Rado, who provides the music I use at the top and tail of every episode. I have a newsletter. It's only once a month, so it's not one of these emails that's going to be coming into your inbox constantly. It is called The Redo, which I think is also a little funny considering when I do audiobook stuff, we're saying, okay, how about one more time? Let's just do that one more time. So somehow my name has become just incumbent in the work that I do. Sign up for The Redo by Michelle Rado at my website, michellerado.com. Thank you so much for making it all the way to the end of this episode, and for most of all, daring to listen. I will catch you next time.
I want to sing out a song today, make peace with thoughts that don't matter at all. Want to turn away from today's raging battles, treat myself gently, break my own fall. I woke up early this morning, my brain shouted out, fought for the day. Stop wasting your time with the things you can't fix. Remember each moment you're fading away. Every damn moment you're fading away. For all I know, I could be wrong. But for all I know, I'm right. For all I know, the lyrics are stolen. But I'm gonna sing out that song that I know. I'm gonna sing out that song that I know. Sometimes it seems like the springtime is smiling. It's easy to follow all those sweet weather birds. And some days you fly without feeling so tired. Some days the burdens, they're greater than words. Some days the burdens, they're greater than words. For all I know, I could be wrong. But for all I know, I'm right. All I know, the lyrics are stolen, but I'm gonna sing out that song that I know. I'm gonna sing out that song that I know. I've flown with eagles, I've often gone soaring, but I've been a rock, tumbled alone. I've been to the mountain, I've danced in the water, and I have been smooth to a fine river stone. I have been smooth to a fine river stone. For all I know, I could be wrong, but for all I know, I'm right. For all I know, the lyrics are stolen, but I'm gonna sing out that song that I know. I'm gonna sing out that song that I know. I'm gonna sing out that song that I know.